The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
A warm welcome back to all of you to another live session at Best Ideas 2018. It's a great pleasure to now welcome returning MOI Global instructor, Chris Crawford. Those of you who've been with us in the past will recall Chris's presentations and ideas, as well as the insights and wisdom he has shared with our community, and I very much look forward to his presentation today. Chris, of course, is the managing partner and chief investment officer of Crawford Fund Management, a Boston-based investment firm. The firm does manage a long-short fund that invests in equities and options with an emphasis on underfollowed public companies. Before co-founding Crawford Fund Management in 2009, Chris was managing director, portfolio manager, and head of the Boston office of Stark Investments, a multi-strategy global hedge fund. Chris, it's a pleasure to have you with us. I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'll be back for the Q&A following your remarks. The floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back at Best Ideas again. I think this is the fifth year that we've done this, so it's always a pleasure to come back and present our idea for the year. I'm going to start with the standard disclaimer that we have to start with every year, which says basically this is not an offer of investment advice. It's really for instructional purposes. It doesn't represent all the advice that we might give to our clients, and past performance doesn't guarantee future results. So with that disclaimer out of the way, we'll move ahead to the presentation. I think it's always good to start just by reviewing the prior ideas, just to let you know which ones are still active and that we still believe in and which ones we've closed out. These are the five ideas that we presented over the past 5 years. Two of them we closed out in the past because they reached their fair values and natural exit points. That was Myriad and Ritchie Brothers Auctions. We continue to hold Ubiquity from 2015, and we continue to hold Americo from 2017 last year, and still like those ideas quite a lot. In the case of Ubiquity, even though it's up 162%, and in the case of U-Haul, has only appreciated 3%, but sometimes these ideas take a few years to work. We still like the company a lot, and our thesis from last year a lot. This year's pick is Diamond Hill Investment Group, which is actually a money management firm, trading at $212 and change as of close yesterday, and that is our best idea for 2018. So let's talk about Diamond Hill. This company, it's a high-quality, differentiated investment management franchise. This is a business that many of us on the call ought to understand quite well, given that we are likely to be in this business if you're interested in this this call, some of you at least. This is a company that is one of the smaller asset managers, 17th largest publicly traded asset manager, equity focused, although they do have some fixed income as well. It's an owner-operated company with a very strong fiduciary culture and a very long-term approach to both managing the funds that they run as well as running their own business, Diamond Hill, that I'm advocating investing in. The stock has generally been either fairly valued or undervalued over the years. It's reached a point where it's lagged the performance of its underlying business. The stock has lagged the business for the past few years and has created what we think is a very attractive entry point for a high-quality growth business. Another near-term tailwind for the company are recent changes in U.S. tax laws, which this company is a very strong beneficiary of those tax laws, given that it's a full taxpayer, and that there can be secondary benefits for the companies through corporate tax changes of the underlying holdings of Diamond Hill's funds. And we also think that there are some paradigm shift potential in equity styles, which styles are in and out of favor that have not favored Diamond Hill for the past few years, but could, looking forward, shift to be from a headwind to a tailwind. Our appraisal is about $340 a share, which gives 60% upside, very attractive. And we think fair value is poised to grow over time as well. So you can get paid two ways, through the narrowing of that discount gap and also fair value growing. You know, I referenced Ubiquity earlier. I think when we pitched Ubiquity at this forum in 2015, we might have had 60% upside in our base case and maybe 100% in our optimistic case. And the stock's intrinsic value, we feel, continued to grow. And the stock's up 160%+, and we still think there's more upside. So there are multiple ways to get paid on some of these ideas. So let's look at the company, the profile of the company, $22 billion in assets under management. That makes it a relatively small asset manager. This is not a company like Fidelity or BlackRock or one of the big mega complexes where you've got a fund in every different category, every style box is covered. This is a company that's very focused on doing a few things very well. The bulk of their assets are in five or six funds, and then they have a range of smaller funds that are typically startup funds that they've incubated for a while and have the potential to grow and become much larger over time. But they'd rather have a few funds that have nice scale advantage and are profitable and have a nicely staked out reason for being in the market rather than just trying to be everything to everyone, which we think is a great strategy. The firm was founded in 2000 by Rick Dillon, who is currently the chairman. He had been CEO up until last year, still very involved in the company. What we love about management in this company is the senior management are still involved in running portfolios, being research analysts, being portfolio managers, which keeps them very close to the investment part of the business. So this is a very investment-driven company. A lot of asset managers, you don't see senior management still running portfolios or doing any kind of stock research, so it's great to see that. It's an active fund manager. You've seen a lot of the trends toward passive investments and ETFs and more just benchmark-driven type of investing. Huge amounts of assets, trillions of assets have flowed into passive investing, and there's a lot of debate going on as to whether passive investing will become the norm and it will sort of replace humans because you can do it better with machine learning or with just simple algorithms, or humans are just on average so bad at managing money that they're bound to lag. This is a company that's really tries to prove that wrong and tries to outperform in the limited things that they try to do quite well. They have a philosophy of intrinsic value-based investing and they don't hug benchmarks. So they're taking a lot of active bets in their portfolios. So money management, just to step back, is a very good business at scale. When it's not at scale, it's actually not a great business, but money management at scale is an excellent business. It's asset light, very high returns on invested capital, very little capital is required to run these businesses other than human capital or intellectual capital. Those pose their own challenges, but it's not like this is building out a big fiber network, or this is not like drilling for oil and gas where you have to put in massive amounts of capital in the hopes that you you strike it rich by hitting a nice seam of commodity. It's a highly scalable business. The more assets you bring into the company, if you're managing it well, a lot of it can flow to the bottom line. Really, the variable part of this variable cost part of the business is client service, the marketing part of the business. But if you're running the investment organization well and you have capacity in your funds and ideas, you can bring in new assets and leverage the same investment talent that you're using to generate performance. So higher AUM typically drives higher margins and higher returns. It's a very difficult business to break into, but while it's an attractive business, it's hard to do. It's very difficult to be trusted to take care of large amounts of other people's money. It requires that you be good at generating performance and that you be good at servicing clients. They're two very different skills and very hard to do either one independently, but to do both simultaneously is an extremely difficult task. Diamond Hill has been excellent at doing both of these key functions for many years now. You get growth from multiple sources. One is the underlying investment performance, the appreciation of your assets underlying in your funds, and also winning new business. So two very attractive ways to grow. When you get both of these things working, you can have extremely high growth rates, like we've seen with Diamond Hill historically, and we think they have the prospect to continue that. Properly developed relationships can be very sticky. These tend to be very sophisticated relationships on the institutional side. It's also very sophisticated in terms of getting distribution. These relationships tend to be long-lasting. They take very long to establish, but once you've established them and if you service them well, they tend to be a nice barrier to entry to keep your franchise. And finally, no bad debt. You collect all your fees directly from the client assets, which is a nice plus. So I want to talk about growth a little bit. You can see the historical growth track record of Diamond Hill. Very attractive. They've grown 17% a year. It's by far the highest growing of the small publicly traded asset management companies. What I find interesting is that you have periods of time in this nice bar chart where you've got underlying asset appreciation and inflows like 2013 and 14, 2010, 2009, both working together to generate very high growth. And then you have years like 2008 where the market was down 37% and Diamond Hill was still able to grow its AUM 2% because they had strong inflows given performance leading up to that year. So this is a young enough company that it's able to grow through, or at least not shrink during really tough times in the market. And when times are going well, they're able to put up some really excellent growth numbers. The capacity of the firm to add assets, a very important question to ask in this business, is how much can you actually run doing what you do well? They believe they have 25 to 35 billion in equity and 40 billion in fixed income versus 22 billion in AUM today. Fixed income is very small for them, so there's still a lot of open room for them to grow there. Less room in equity, but still plenty of room to keep growing at these type of growth rates for the foreseeable future. And the other issue is that these companies tend to find ways to grow their capacity over time, either by adding new analysts, finding new areas of competence where they can continue to do what they do, their intrinsic value investing approach, or to launch new products. Actually, just this morning, the company announced that it's launching a new global product for the first time. It's the first time they've done anything substantial outside domestic markets. They've incubated a fund for 4 years, have a good track record, and now they're launching a new product. So that's an example of how you can grow capacity, is by growing your sphere of competence. Next, let's talk about sources of growth in terms of distribution channels. What's very nice here, it's divided into two sections, this table. This institutional distribution channels on the lower half, and then proprietary channels, things like RIAs, wirehouses, banks, defined contribution plans on the top half. The top half of the chart, they've had healthy growth in all these different distribution channels. I like to see multiple sources of distribution. I like to see them all growing and healthy. You're not overly dependent upon one source of distribution. These tend to be businesses that require going out into the field, having a lot of meetings, going local with your marketing plan, and persuading a lot of different people to support you and be an advocate for your product. They've done a great job of that. Institutional business, you tend to get bigger pieces of business from each client, but it's a much more competitive, cutthroat kind of business with lower fees. Decisions can be made that can take large chunks of assets in or out of your fund complex. So this is a business that I sort of consider to be the gravy part of the business, the bonus part of the business. They've had their ups and downs. They're basically flat to where they were in 2013. But if they keep doing a good job of managing and putting up numbers in their funds, they're going to, over time, continue, I think, to grow institutional business as well. So next page, we'll talk about the profitability of the business, the operating efficiency of the business. The key metric in an asset management company is your revenue per employee, because most of your assets, your costs are in your employees, and in particular, your investment employees. You can see here that portfolio managers and analysts, the headcount has grown steadily over the years. Same with research analysts and traders. This is the expensive part of the human capital, not to shortchange people on the client side of the business. That's extremely important too, but this is the core of the business. This is what generates your performance. And Diamond Hill has done a great job of growing assets faster than they've grown employees. That's not true in all asset management companies. Many companies have stumbled by, when times are good, adding employees way too quickly. And then when bear markets come, they have to retrench and lay off people because they've taken on too much cost. Diamond Hill's done a great job of having very lean and mean portfolio management and research teams. And you can see that they've grown their investment revenue per investment employee from about $1.5 million 10 years ago to about $2.5 million today. Those are, in the absolute, fantastic numbers for any business. And the trend is also excellent as well. And that's a key part of how they've been able to grow their net margin from the mid-20s to almost the mid-30s, which is really almost an unthinkably high net margin for any business. And you hardly see any companies that can sustainably, consistently generate these type of net margins. This is the kind of business where it can be done for those select few who are excellent at their business. Next is a look at some of the product lineup within Diamond Hill. I have a slide on long-only funds, and then the next one will be on their alternative-based funds. Within long-only, these are the key funds. There are a few others, but these are the core ones. Most of them 4 or 5 star rated on Morningstar. You know, Morningstar ratings, while they may not be predictive of future performance, they are very interesting in that most of the net inflows in the mutual fund business still go into 4 and 5 star Morningstar rated funds. So to have these designations is a great thing for any company. And it's a big part of why they've continued to be able to get inflows in an environment where many equity funds have been seeing actually net outflows over the past decade. It's pretty remarkable to see a company in this business having net inflows. And it's because they're doing such a great job managing the assets, you can see that over the longer timeframes, that from inception, the 3, 5, 10-year periods, that many of these funds are in the top quartile and even top decile in some cases. Near-term, one-year performance, they've been kind of below average for about two-thirds of the funds below average. But that kind of ties back to my point that this has not been a great environment for them. We've been in more of a momentum-driven as opposed to value-driven or intrinsic value-driven market, yet their long-term records are still very much intact. The biggest and most important funds in this group would be the large cap funds, Diamond Hill Large Cap. It's a big fund, multi-billion dollar fund. This Diamond Hill Large Cap Concentrated is a concentrated version of that fund. Much younger fund, it's smaller in assets, has potential over time. I do find it interesting that the absolute returns in the concentrated fund are significantly higher over these 5 years than they are in the non-concentrated version. It's sort of a reminder that sometimes your best 20 or 30 ideas is going to outperform your best 70 or 80 ideas. The small mid-cap funds are very differentiated. They have good track record. They're $2 to $3 billion worth of assets, have the potential to grow more. There's more capacity there. You can get higher fees on these products. So that's kind of long only. The fees are lower at Diamond Hill funds than 80% of their peers, despite delivering superior performance. So you can see the value that they're delivering to the marketplace. Here's a list of their alternative funds. So these are long short funds. They're an early pioneer in developing long short funds for mutual fund distribution channel. The Diamond Hill Long Short Fund is a flagship fund. It was launched in 2000, has a very long track record, superior track record. They're in mostly in the top quartile for these longer periods of time versus their peers. I've outperformed the category. It's about a $5 billion fund. It's actually closed for new business, for new customers. I think existing fund holders can add to their accounts, but they're closed to new business, which shows discipline. They will reopen the fund as opportunities warrant it. This is a high fee product, gets substantially higher fees because of the hedging component. It's done a great job over the years. It's sort of a flagship product for the category as well as for the firm. They have a smaller version of it focused on financials. They have a corporate credit fund, which also has a decent track record. They have a high yield fund, which is not listed on here as well, which is relatively new, but also has an excellent track record. So there's a lot of differentiation in here. There's a lot of ways to set themselves aside from the market. I think also looking forward, the market has not been good for equity long short. Hedge funds in the equity space have really struggled over the past, since the financial crisis, really because of the straight up kind of unabated equity markets. And if you think about how Diamond Hill's managed to do so well with some of their funds not being ideally suited to that market, I do like the hedging aspects of this, that if we had a more challenging market, valuations are getting high. If we were to have more of a correction or a bear market, funds like Diamond Hill Long Short are going to outperform massively and be in a position to actually try to bring in new assets again. Same with the fixed income, specialty fixed income parts of their business. So let's move to talk about management a bit. There's a lot of important people at Diamond Hill. They've got a lot of investment professionals that have been around the firm for a decade plus, lots of long tenured, very experienced people. The turnover is extremely low. You don't see that in a lot of asset management companies. These are two key people. Rick Dillon founded the firm, is now chairman. He's still involved in running a few of the funds. He actually runs the short book for the long short strategy. And then Chris Bingaman was named CEO last year. He's also still running long short and works on a mid-cap fund. It's great to have senior management still with skin in the game, still every day having to research stocks. It makes them make better decisions about how to run the firm, how to manage investment professionals. And I think they get a lot more respect from the investment professionals in the firm, given they do it as well. Many firms are run by lawyers or asset gatherers, not so much the investment professionals. So it's when you have an investment-driven firm, I think you're more likely to succeed. The performance of Diamond Hill stock and the funds themselves are much more important than salary for almost everybody in this firm, all the key employees in this firm. 23% of the firm is owned by employees, $165 million. And those same employees have about $150 million invested in Diamond Hill funds. That's over $1 million per employee. So they're really eating their own cooking, which I think is key to success. Strong fiduciary culture. They've done a lot of things for the long term. They're willing to make decisions that in the short term maybe are detrimental, like closing funds rather than continue to take in new assets when they could easily do so. That takes discipline because you're giving up short-term profitability, but you're preserving the ability to perform in that fund. You're preserving the ability to treat your clients well, and that pays off over the long term. You saw a lot of big asset management firms that have crashed and burned, made the mistakes of just doing what was, you know, hot, what was the flavor of the month, sucking in enormous amounts of assets. Tech bubble was a great example of that. Firms taking in, you know, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in assets and not being able to put that money to work effectively for clients. You don't see that at Diamond Hill. I also like the fact that these guys are located in Columbus, Ohio. This is a college town, big university town, but it's really isolated from the big money center, Wall Street kind of culture. It's a way to avoid the distraction that you might see if you were located in New York. And you also have access to a lot of intellectual talent in a college town like that, that is going to be a lot lower cost. So as Diamond Hill owners, we like getting as much brain power as we can for the least amount of payment that we have to pay. So valuation, target price, $340+ per share. The method we're using the most in valuing this, we always use multiple methods, but the one we really hang our hat on here is our DCF model, which has three scenarios: the base case, a bear case, and an upside case. The base case, which we give 50% weight, has a value of about $320 a share. It assumes that we have a small correction in the financial markets in the next couple of years, and that net flows remain positive, but they diminish from how strong they've been recently, that we see gradual fee compression. That's a phenomenon occurring all over the industry, but the Diamond Hill basically experiences industry levels of fee compression, and that the margins are flat, and despite growth, they're not able to scale margins any further because they have to reinvest in costs to service clients or in fee give back. So you'll see the models. We'll come to the actual models on these, and you can see how this all flows through quantitatively, but those are the key assumptions that drive that scenario. So that's $320. The bear case, we get 25% weight. The value is $173. That's a bit below where the stock is trading, but not severe downside. The key assumptions here are that we get a substantial bear market within the next 2 years, but that Diamond Hill is able to outperform because part of its assets are in a long short asset class and because of their fixed income exposure. We assume that the net flows turn negative, but that they do stabilize, but below where we assume in the base case. We assume more rapid fee compression than the base case, and that margins fall quite sharply, as they did in the financial crisis, but that they actually don't recover after that, that it becomes a permanent new normal. You'll see that quantitatively again. Upside case, 25% weight, very substantial upside, over $550 a share. Our assumptions there are that we have continued positive markets. We've got a strong economy. We've got building consumer confidence. We've got strengthening labor markets. Overall bonds are still relatively quite unattractive relative to equities. You could actually have another, you know, later stage of the economy and the bull market where stocks could continue to perform for a number of years. Wouldn't be unheard of. Things aren't quite as euphoric and exuberant as they were in prior peaks like 1999. We could still have a few years to go. We've kind of built that scenario into this scenario, and we assume that Diamond Hill style also thrives in this environment, that the intrinsic value approach starts to outperform along with robust equity markets. Net flows remain strong for the next 3 years, and then they kind of revert to normal. We assume that fee rates don't erode, that they're actually able to hold them steady, and that they're able to scale margins a bit more, 300 bips more, and then they will flatten and no more after that. So those are kind of the three cases. You can make variations, all kinds of variations in between or outside of the bounds of these scenarios, but these are the ones that we think are sort of the three most likely. You can also play with the weights of these scenarios too, but it's the weighted average of these that takes us to 342. We've also looked at relative valuation methodologies, which I'll show you on some future slides as well, to look at where the Diamond Hill stands relative to its history in terms of different sort of shortcut methods. It's pretty consistent with what the absolute intrinsic value approach that we use is saying. You know, interesting, we're using an intrinsic value approach to value a company that likes to invest with intrinsic value. It's quite appropriate, I guess. I'll point out also that we're not giving the company any credit for launching new funds like the global fund they announced this morning. And they don't just announce funds willy-nilly. They put a lot of work, 4 years in this case, into the fund they announced today. So when they launch a new fund, I take it quite seriously that it's a real opportunity. Aggressive stock buyback. The stock's quite undervalued. These are rational actors. They could easily take the large balance. They actually have quite a large balance of cash and investments in their own mutual funds. They could easily allocate some of that capital into buying back stock if they felt the stock was undervalued enough. And finally, they could be bought out by a larger company. It's easy to see, given how cheap the stock is trading, how much upside there could be in valuation, and also why a larger company would want to buy the growth that exists in Diamond Hill, because it's so hard to grow for many of these larger companies. And you could consolidate back offices and get a lot of efficiency out of that. And people would love to have access to the talent at Diamond Hill. I'm not sure how happy Diamond Hill would be about selling itself out and having to mix into a much larger culture, but you could imagine a scenario if the bull market continues on and things get more heated and exuberant. You could easily imagine a scenario where animal spirits start to flow and people start to throw out some much, much higher offers. I think it would require an offer higher than what we're modeling in our scenarios, but it's a call option that exists if you're thinking longer term about holding stock like this. So I mentioned the relative valuation. We'll touch on relative valuation first, and then I'll show you the detailed intrinsic value models. So this looks at PE over the past 10 years. We're currently trading around the low end of the range. There was a brief period where it went off the charts here during the financial crisis because of a one-time restructuring issue charge. But otherwise, it's relatively at the lower end of where it's been. And on EV to EBITDA, which normally is a flawed metric because EBITDA doesn't really measure free cash flow. But in this type of a business, it's actually sort of a useful metric because capital spending is not a big deal in asset management. And also because the cash holdings make the enterprise value actually substantially lower than the market cap. So it's kind of an interesting chart. The stock got very oversold during the financial crisis. And that charge didn't hit EBITDA the way it did hit EPS, GAAP EPS, in this other chart, hence the inverted difference between how those charts look during that brief period, but basically ignore that period for both charts. And the lower center lower chart looks at the blue line is what the value of the stock would be at a PE of 18, and the green line is the stock price. The blue line actually dramatically understates the value because there's also about $40 a share in cash and marketable securities that actually adds to that. So you would basically shift that entire blue chart up if you were adjusting for that over time. And you can see that a gap has opened up over the past couple of years between the stock price and that price at PE implied line. And generally, whenever a gap has opened up like that of any significance, that's been a good period for the stock to outperform. It happened here in 2012 and 13, and this is actually a significantly bigger gap. Up here, percentage-wise even. So that's relative valuation. So actually, maybe before I go to the summary of the investment thesis, I'm going to go down to the models and just show you some of the cases and how we modeled them. This is Appendix 1A. This is a base case where we had the $320 valuation. Everything in blue here up to 16 is historical, and then 17 and on is forecasted. We tend to use the red numbers for assumptions, blue numbers for things that are fact, historical fact, black numbers for things that are calculated. So we're projecting the fund. We do two things here. We aggregate up the performance of the assets of the funds, and we also aggregate net flows to get to an AUM for each year. And then we look at fee rates to calculate projected revenues. And then we project margins to get to profit items. So for fund returns, we model 12% for 2017. It's probably going to come in actually higher than that, just given that we sort of know how the year has come out. So that number probably could be nudged up a bit. 18, we're modeling a modest year. Then we model a mini bear market or a correction in 2019. Again, this is Diamond Hill's performance, not the market. So the market would maybe be negative 10% in that scenario for 2019. We think Diamond Hill outperforms given their exposure to fixed income and long short, as well as potential to outperform with greater margin of safety and an intrinsic value fund. Then we have a bounce back year, and then we have it settling in at 7% for the long term and then their underlying fund returns. Equity markets generally have done better than that, but we've also been through a 9-year bull market, followed by this mini correction. One would expect that perhaps returns could be a few hundred basis points less than historic, given the starting conditions. So that's how we model that. Organic growth we have at about 3%, with a flat year during the bear market or the correction, which is actually lower than the historical rates of bringing in organic net inflows. So there's some built-in conservatism here. Revenue per AUM down here has steadily declined from the mid-70s to high 60s basis points on AUM. We're modeling that continuing to erode to 63. I think that's just the reality of the industry. Even good firms need to manage in some kind of fee compression into their planning horizon. We hold margins flat. Here's one big item is the tax rate declining, corporate tax rate declining to 21% is really technically what it should be. We model it at 22%, assuming there'll be 100 bips of leakage somewhere relative to the new statutory rate. As a full taxpayer, it's a big deal for Diamond Hill. It frees up a lot of capital for them to, you know, reward shareholders or to hire new employees or to launch new funds. We think most likely they'll use it to hire more employees and invest in growth for the firm. So excess cash is modeled down here. I mean, all in all, it's pretty straightforward, pretty simple business to model. This is not one of the more complex businesses that we model. The real intelligence is in this, net inflows versus fund return assumptions up here and what you're assuming about fees and margins. So that's the that was the base case. This is the bear case. I'm not sure when that slide switched, but the bear case we'll cover now. It's just more pessimistic up here. It's a full bear market where the market's down 20-25%. Diamond Hill holds up better at only negative 15. It goes on for another year after that, and then they have a small bounce back year. Net flows stay negative and never really recover. And that's sort of assuming some secular negativity in the industry as well. And then on fee compression, we model it declining even further. It went down to 63 in the base case. It's down to 57 bips in this one, so quite a bit more severe. Margins drop severely from 47 to 39 and never recover. Permanent step down. 200 bips of tax leakage, but we still give them credit for the bulk of the tax law change. I mean, that's pretty much baked in. It's a permanent tax law change. And that gets us target price of 173. Everything else is the same. Oh, we put a lower terminal multiple. I didn't mention in the prior one, we use a 15 terminal multiple on earnings for the base case, a 13 for the bear case. This is a number given depending on the interest rate regime, that would be consistent with a very slow growth company that might be growing at maybe 3-5% a year, a very mature type of business. Finally, the upside case, we model the equity paradigm staying very healthy, not having any kind of near-term correction or bear market. That it's sort of just we've recovered from the financial crisis, and that we're now sort of in a normalized environment where markets can go up roughly 8-10% a year, with an occasional good year and an occasional bad year. And that Diamond Hill continues on with fund returns in the 8-9 range. We've modeled in one kind of really good year with 18%. They certainly had years better than that in the past. We model very good organic growth, sort of consistent with what it's been in the past, but no down years. We model in fees staying about the same and margins staying about the same, full credit for the tax rate change. And that's how you get mid 500s per share for a target price. So those are the scenarios that we're modeling. So I'll come back to two more slides. We'll summarize the investment thesis, and then we'll talk about some of the risks and watchouts and the bear case on Diamond Hill, and then we'll wrap it up at that point. So core investment tenets to summarize, it's a great business with great economics, scalable, high return on invested capital. It's a business that has grown and has plenty of growth opportunity remaining. We think the funds at Diamond Hill are poised to outperform if the market paradigm shifts from the very much momentum-driven type of investments that have worked well in equity markets recently. There's a lot of ETFs and passive capital chasing the FANG-type stocks. Those aren't the kind of stocks that Diamond Hill holds. They hold a lot of large blue-chip quality companies in their large-cap funds, but they tend to be companies where there's much more of a value case. It doesn't mean that it's a non-growing company, but it just means that they have a case for the company being intrinsically undervalued. That type of investment could come back into favor, which could be a tailwind. If we generally get more inflation and higher interest rates in the world, higher growth rates, that could be a more favorable backdrop for equities. That would also benefit Diamond Hill. alignment of interest. We talked about them eating their own cooking extensively in the prior slide. Attractive valuation across multiple methods, consolidation potential. We've touched on that. The tax law we've talked about. And one final point, smaller point, but they exited a fund administration business that they created and incubated themselves internally. Last year, they sold this business for a very nice price. It was only about 15% of the value of the company, or revenues of the company, probably a little bit less in terms of value. They got a good price for it. It actually frees up capital and management attention to focus on the investment business. So we think that was a good shareholder-friendly decision that they made. So what are the concerns and risks in the investment? First, that this passive shift in the equity market continues unabated, and that a lot of the customers and distribution channels that they sell through ultimately conclude, why pay humans to do this work? We should just outsource this to robots, and we should be paying 10 bips or 12 bips for this. We shouldn't be paying 68 bips for this. No value added. How can I pick the winning humans? That shift continues unabated, and then it actually starts to affect Diamond Hill a lot more than it has, more like the way that it's affected other big fund complexes that have not delivered good performance. Fees and expense ratios are under attack. That could continue on past the time horizon of our model. Fees could continue to erode. Maybe they'll go into the 20s and 30s of bips on assets under management, and that would require a whole new approach to running the business. We've been through a nine-year bull market. The odds of it, some kind of correction occurring, bear market occurring, continue to increase the more the market inflates. While Diamond Hill, we hope, will outperform, and it has its hedged product, inevitably there'll be some AUM loss and also loss of client confidence, generally speaking. The chairman has been selling down his stake to diversify his holdings. Never like to see management selling a lot of stock. I do understand it in the case of someone who's been there a long time and has moved into a chairman role. He still will own a lot of stock. But the good news is that he's putting most of the capital into Diamond Hill funds. So his method of diversification is not to take the money and go buy some other assets outside of Diamond Hill, but to put it in the funds because they are diversified, which I find that to be very friendly to us as shareholders. Diamond Hill does actually, I didn't really touch on this, but they have launched their own S&P 500 ETF that's sort of a smart beta product where they're rebalancing based upon intrinsic value within the S&P 500. Very clever product. It's actually got good performance in the short period of time it's been operating, but it's been very slow to ramp, as have several of their other newer products that are still kind of stuck at around 30 to 50 million, which is basically the seed capital that they put in plus a few smaller new clients. I'd like to see those products start to ramp better because some of them are performing well and are quite differentiated ideas. Finally, we're in the paradigm where the momentum is in and the value is out of vogue. That could continue for quite some time. If you remember 1999, the way that bull market ended was actually not really with value outperforming during the bull market. It was actually with exponential increases in extremely risky, overvalued types of stocks, not the type of stocks that Diamond Hill owns. There's the possibility that if we had something like that occur, that kind of late stage bull market, animal spirits bull market, I suspect Diamond Hill would continue to perform poorly, and it might be so bad that it could take down their 3 and 5 year numbers to not looking so good. Now, many of the disciplined value-oriented shops performed extremely well during the tech crash from 2000 to 2002. Some of them actually made money in the absolute, even when the market was down 50%. Alpha was tremendous. I think Diamond Hill would be well poised to be in that environment, but it could be very painful if we get an exponential final blow-off stage to the bull market. So I think that's a pretty good point to stop and see if there are any questions.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for articulating your thesis. Just a reminder to everyone listening, if you have a question, you can type it into the online interface now. I will start with a question from the queue. It says, how are the incentives of the PMs aligned with the shareholders? Have we seen turnover in key personnel?
Sure, great questions for an asset management company, very key items. There's been extremely low turnover within Diamond Hill, very few cases of key portfolio managers and analysts leaving the firm. Not unheard of, it does happen, but it's extremely low relative to other firms. In terms of incentives, most of their incentives for analysts and portfolio managers are oriented towards longer-term time horizons, which is not the case in every asset management company. Sometimes people get paid on an annual basis. Sometimes it's 3 years. But these folks have big portions of their bonuses tied to 3 and 5 year periods. They're also required, the more senior they are, to take almost or up to all of their compensation in the form of Diamond Hill stock, or hold the bonuses in the funds themselves, the funds that they manage or that the firm manages. And they have long vesting periods as well. I believe it's 5 year vesting periods to earn that money. So if they perform well 1 year and there's a huge, they give it all back, then they don't necessarily earn everything from that 1 year. So it's one of the more fair compensation systems that I've seen in this industry.
So just as a follow-up or clarification, it sounds like they do hold a fair amount of compensation as restricted stock. If they, let's say, decide to switch firms, what would you expect typically to be kind of an amount of stock that's forfeited? Because I assume there's a rolling component to this.
Yeah, typically, it would be a function of how long you've been at the firm. I think the industry standard when there's deferred comp like that is that 3 years is typical vesting period. I believe it's longer for Diamond Hill. I haven't had a chance to review the actual language in their employees' contracts, but I think it's 5 years for in most cases. So if someone, a manager, had been there 15 years and had built up 15 years worth of comp, they would probably be entitled to the first 10 years of it and maybe some small portion or of the next 5 years, and probably nothing from the final 3 years. So it's a pretty strong incentive to not hop firms.
One interesting statistic is AUM to market cap, or rather market cap to AUM, or more precisely enterprise value to AUM. It looks like Diamond Hill is around 3% on that metric. Mm-hmm. Do you ever look at that metric, and how does it compare versus other smaller asset managers on that metric?
Yeah, it's very difficult to make that comparison from firm to firm because the firms are constructed so differently. The profitability of the firms is different. There's kind of rules of thumb about what these stocks should trade at. 4% is a number that they often is kind of cited average for the industry, and maybe slightly larger at the smaller end of the spectrum. But the firms are so different from each other in terms of the asset classes they're in. Some are more fixed income oriented. They should trade at a lower multiple of AUM because the fees and fixed income are quite a bit lower. It depends upon the efficiency that the firm is operated at. So I really prefer to do a custom analysis for each firm. I do feel that 3% is very low for Diamond Hill, given if you look at deals, the history of deals in the industry when takeouts happen, the 4 to 5% for active management with a well-run business is not uncommon. A franchise like Diamond Hill would probably go at a premium to that. I prefer to do the kind of analysis we did where you really look at the fundamentals driving each individual firm. But if Diamond Hill were to be bought out and it went at 5% or 6% of AUM, that would be consistent with what the DCF models are saying, or at least the upside case of the DCF model is saying, which is more like what a buyout scenario might look like.
And perhaps lastly, Chris, it would be helpful to maybe get a little bit of a sense for how you view the macro. Obviously, we are bottom-up investors, but this is an idea that is quite closely tied, at least in the short term or medium term, to the market or performance of the market. And you did obviously build in that 10% assumed decline, I believe, in 2019 or 2020. But what is your general view that makes you comfortable holding this position?
Yeah, it's a good question. We think a lot about what is the risk budget that we tolerate in our portfolio for things that are very economically sensitive or have a tie to the equity markets, because these type of stocks are obviously very sensitive to the economy and to the markets. And if there's a severe downturn, you have to consider the impact on the holding. So it's within a budget, it's within a portion of our portfolio that we're willing to allocate to that type of stock. But in terms of our macro view, we actually are fairly bullish on the economy. We're seeing a lot of signs that confidence is growing among consumers and businesses, that capital spending is increasing. We're in an environment where we went through a severe crash, obviously, in 2008 and 9. We went through a very sluggish period of recovery where confidence never really got to full strength. It feels like we're entering the kind of, you know, the third of an expansion phase where people really get pretty optimistic and start to take more risks. You see them opening new offices, entering new markets, hiring more people. You're starting to see wage inflation for the first time. You're just seeing a lot more confidence. You're seeing less regulation. The tax laws are obviously free up a lot of capital within fully taxed corporations to reinvest in their businesses, or to do acquisitions, or to even if they're just doing buybacks, it still increases the value of their equity, which in turn has a feedback effect on confidence. So we listen to thousands of company conference calls over the course of a year, and it's a very good granular bottom-up ways to hear companies talk about what they're thinking about and what they're actually doing at the local bottoms-up company level. And there's so much, when you listen to hundreds of these calls over the past 6 months, there's just so much change in tone that you sense that makes us just feel like this expansion could actually go on for a few more years. Actually, even though we're 9 years into it, it could actually become one of the longest expansions in economic history in this country. Now, you have to separate that view from the market, because the market's forward-looking mechanism, the market understands this. I expect that markets, as is typical, will peak before the economy peaks. So two different things. We could easily have a year or two lag between the two, or a year lag between the two. But we're generally pretty positive, and we're kind of building that into the planning horizons of a lot of the companies we're modeling.
Terrific. Well, Chris, I want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for returning again to this forum and taking the time to share your investment thesis. We truly appreciate it.
Great. Nice to be with you.
And to all of you listening, thanks for being with us. I'd encourage a dialogue with Chris. So if you have thoughts or questions, feel free to reach out to him or contact us, and we will be happy to facilitate an introduction. Goodbye for now. I will see you for our next live session in about 40 minutes.